Mateo came for testing when he was 16. He walked into my office ambivalent and walked out on top of the world. You wouldn't think getting a diagnosis of dyslexia could make such a difference, but what it said to Mateo was that he wasn't dumb. There was a reason it took him so much longer to do his homework than his friends, and it wasn't his fault. I get excited when kids like Mateo come into our office because I know when they're done with their cognitive learning therapy, the challenges that brought them in the first place won't be such a hindrance anymore. Today, we're digging into dyslexia. We'll look at dyslexic profiles, identity development, and self-esteem in dyslexic students, and the connection and confusion with dyslexia, dysgraphia, and ADHD. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning differences, dyslexia, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers, and author of At Wit's End, A Parent's Guide to Ending the Struggle, Tears, and Turmoil of Learning Disabilities. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens struggle in school and what can be done to change that permanently. To get a free copy, go to parents@witsend.com. Let's say hello to Lauren, our moderator and the Director of Clinical Growth and Operations at Stowell Learning Centers. Good morning, Lauren.
Good morning. Hello to everyone who is out there. I'm really excited about today's topic of dyslexia, and it was so cool because recently one of our parents actually posted on Instagram. Let me make sure I get the quote right. She said, 6 months ago, we were given the gift of putting a name to the struggles our daughter was having, dyslexia. And we hear that all the time. So many parents tell us that knowing what you're dealing with is a gift. It helps you understand, empathize, and find the right path to help. So if you or your child has a diagnosis of dyslexia, how did naming the challenge make you feel?
Thank you, Lauren. This is LD Expert Live. I'm your host, Jill Stowell. Our guest today is Dr. Dan Peters. Dr. Dan is a psychologist, co-founder and executive director of Summit Center, and co-founder of Parent Footprint. He is the author of the Make Your Worrier a Warrior series of books, providing easy-to-follow practical strategies for both parents and children. Dr. Dan is a frequent speaker and writer on topics related to parenting, family, giftedness, twice exceptionality, dyslexia, and anxiety. He is host of the Parent Footprint podcast. Welcome, Dr. Dan.
Jill, good to be back.
It is such a pleasure to have you back on the show. So last time you were here, you were just about to release your new book, Bright, Complex Kids, Supporting Their Social-Emotional Development. It's out now, so congratulations.
Thank you.
What will people find in this book?
Well, my colleague, Dr. Jean Peterson, and I hope people will find a user-friendly guide to just about anything and everything you want to know about who these bright kids are. How do we locate them? What does it mean? How are they different? What are their needs? And then aspects of how do we deal with achievement and underachievement? How do we deal with anxiety? How do we deal with depression, perfectionism? How do we deal with something you all do so well, diagnosis and misdiagnosis, building resilience, and also, of course, parenting them. And so, our goal was to take loads of information from our clinical experience and Jean's extensive research experience and put it in a format that could be digestible for all those who care about bright kids.
Wow, that sounds like an incredible resource for parents and professionals, actually. So, Well, today I want to focus on one group of those bright, complex kids, those with dyslexia. This is a topic that is near and dear to both of us. Mm-hmm. What is your story around dyslexia?
Okay. It's an interesting story. So psychologist in the field, doing a lot of testing, doing a lot of counseling, really passionate about trying to understand kids, questioning the challenge, as we'll talk about, of labeling versus not labeling and the pros and cons of labeling. And lo and behold, our oldest, who is the end of preschool, we have the ending preschool teacher session with this very seasoned preschool teacher. And she says, you know, your daughter is having trouble picking up letters. She's having trouble picking up numbers. She's having trouble with sounds and matching them to the symbols. And I really think you guys should get her an evaluation. So here I am in the field doing this for a living. But in those rooms, I'm just a parent. And I say, we walk out and I say to my wife, you know, I think this teacher is just overreacting, and, you know, development comes in all shapes and sizes, and she's just going into kindergarten. And, you know, I just think this is just too much. I don't think we should get her tested right now. Right. So classic, it can be a classic parent response, even if you think you know what you're doing. So lo and behold, kindergarten, the same things happened. We do get her tested. We get her tested by actually a close friend of mine, who's a colleague, and she does the testing, and we get feedback under the perfect conditions, like in our kitchen, sitting at our kitchen table with someone we trust. And she starts saying all of these words of slow processing, phonetic deficits, working memory challenges. And I just remember glossing over, and I remember the tears welling up in my face. And it's like, how did this happen? You know, like, what does this mean? And here I am, you know, in the field, but also as a parent, overwhelmed. The reason I bring up that beginning of the story is because it completely changed the way I did the work. And having given that feedback that way so many times, the way we're taught, is realizing what it feels like as a parent to hear these clinical words, and how our words on paper and how our words are presented, how important it is in our messaging. So we're on the road, we figure out what dyslexia is, we start the multisensory learning, we're concerned our son, who's coming next, who's really quick-witted, really extensive vocabulary, that he's gonna pass up his sister, and that's gonna really be a hit for her self-esteem. And so that didn't happen, because by first grade, he couldn't spell his name, which was Joe, even though he was teaching me large words. So there goes number two. 2 years later, we have this other young child coming along, and she's in kindergarten. And my wife, by this time, had actually started to get trained as a dyslexic interventionalist. And she said, you know, I'm a little concerned. I'm seeing some of the signs. I'm like, no way. There's no way. You can't do 3 for 3. Like, that doesn't happen. We go to our dyslexic expert, and she says, yes, number three. And then here's the pivotal thing. She turns to us and says, so if you have 3 for 3, that means basically that both of you likely are carriers and or have also have dyslexia. And she said, Dan, think of all the things that you are strong at, and think of all the things that have given you challenges over the years. And my whole school history came back, and just, I saw it all. And I was like, oh my God, I've been living this. This story my whole life as well. Turned out my wife, who was even in gait reading classes because she could read quickly but really didn't remember much of what she read, also has a different version of the profile. So one big happy family of dyslexics, and really just pedal to the metal on passion for the field and trying to help understand it, detect it, and get people on their way of being the best versions of themselves.
Wow. What a story, and all that you learned as a psychologist in all of that too.
Yeah.
So let's, when we talked before, you kind of used the term stealth dyslexia when you were talking about yourself. So how does it happen that kids can be dyslexic and no one knows it?
Yeah, so stealth dyslexia was coined by colleagues, Drs. Brock and Fernette Idy, who are up in the Washington state area, and they wrote an amazing book called The Dyslexic Advantage and have a nonprofit called The Dyslexic Advantage. So they coined the term. Mm-hmm. And what they found in their center, and then we have since, over the past several years, found the same profile as so many of our kids, as I know you do as well, Jill, is these are bright kids who are able to read well enough or are able to compensate well enough using their strengths, their brights, their brightness, and yet they still have a dyslexic profile. So what happens is if you have a higher intellectual capacity and you can hack the system, you can still read down here, which in education terms usually means you're meeting at great expected levels. Mm-hmm. And we know in many states, including California, the low end of great expected levels is quite low. So what happens is you get by. The other thing that happens is you're behind the whole year, and at the very end of the year, you barely catch up. If you're a very bright and stealth dyslexic, what happens is you just learn how to scan and you have great comprehension. So everyone assumes you're decoding well. And then we have many of these stealth dyslexics that we don't diagnose until middle school, high school, college, and sometimes even in graduate school. Because what happens is as the load gets heavier, the words get smaller, the terms grow in volume, the quantity and speed, everything ramps up. The dyslexic brain, as we'll discuss, has trouble with those, that type of processing and details. So you can get by for a long time with frustration, with things taking a long time, with an emotional toll, with everyone thinking like, I don't know, what's wrong? You're so smart, or you have such a high vocabulary, or, you know, if you just try a little harder and apply yourself more. So it really can get missed.
Mm-hmm. And so how does that affect that student going through? I mean, it seems like they're doing okay, you know, how does that, but they know that they're struggling, I'm sure.
They usually know. I mean, it's rare that someone doesn't know that something's up. And the other thing is I always use this example, like you only know how toast tastes until you have toast at someone else's house, right? Like, so if your toast is always burnt, you just assume all toast is burnt until you go to someone else's house. So you start to only know how you process information, and then you start to make attributions about it. So there's a struggle, there's hiding, there's, you know, there's trying to get ways around things. There's not wanting to be called on in class, not wanting people to see your sloppy handwriting. You know, there can be a lot of lurking. Looping it back to my story is that, you know, I didn't find out till I was somewhere between, I want to say 38 and 41, 39, 41, when I found out. I already had my career. I had things going, the center. And it was the first time that I actually felt smart is when I learned that I was dyslexic.
Interesting.
And so it does take a hit on how you feel about yourself, because we equate good grades with intelligence. And when we do that in school, we have all of these bright kids with learning processing differences that don't feel smart and start to assume the way they write, the way they spell, the way they perform on tests, regardless of the way they can talk about the content, then determines their intelligence.
Which can really impact their identity and their choices.
For sure. And
kind of give them a skewed perspective.
I can't tell you how many, I'm sure you have this experience as well, how many times we're giving feedback to parents about their kids, especially when we do elaborate testing. And, you know, a parent's like, that could be me, that you just described me. There's so many parents that find out that way, the way I found out. Right. And so many of them say these terrible things that they were told by middle school and high school teachers. And this is, again, these are some teachers, of course, not all teachers, but so many of them who are very successful now were told that they will never be able to go to college. They should mm-hmm. just pick their, you know, their trade right now. And of course, the trades are an amazing opportunity. And a lot of dyslexics are amazing at the trades because of their visual spatial strengths. But to tell a student they don't have options when they're in sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade, I mean, and that's the feedback that you then internalize. Again, I'm not smart. I only can do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from your standpoint, both as a parent and as a psychologist, how do we help are dyslexic students then socially and emotionally?
Well, you know, one of the topics of identification. So having a child understand what this profile is, mm-hmm. what it's called, I mean, it could be called anything, but what it's called, so you name it, to me is half the battle. It's like it's 50% of it, because then all of a sudden again, oh, so the reason I have trouble reading is because of this. The reason I can't remember how to spell these words or these grammar rules is because of this. Oh, the reason that it takes me longer to think about these school-related tasks is because of this. And because of this profile, I also tend to be strong in my visual spatial awareness and design and problem solving. And I might be a really good storyteller, and I might be a really good inventor, and I might be really intuitive and understand people really well. And that all of this is me. All of this comes with it, because we you know, our kids are in school. Well, thankfully now most of them are back in school for so many hours a day. And when that experience of that training is, this is hard, I'm stressed, I don't know what to do, I'm in the lowest groups, they understand it, I don't, I never finish. As you said, it weighs on their identity. So we have to pull it back, pull the curtain back and say, this is your whole profile. Mm-hmm. And here are the things that we can do to support you. We can give you more time. We can have you dictate. We can have you listen to the teacher and not take notes, so you can actually use your brain to learn instead of trying to keep up with your handwriting and have your working memory of what they're saying now, what they were saying back then. We can give you some taking tests in a quiet environment. We can find ways for you to show your knowledge in other ways than just time tests. You can have audiobooks. Like, there's so many ways that then the information comes out that's commensurate with the child's cognitive ability, which then they realize, you know what? I am smart. I have trouble doing this, but I'm smart. And I'm not, you know, this isn't about building people up to have inflated senses of themselves, because kids with learning challenges rarely have inflated sense of themselves, right? It's quite the opposite, right? So we're trying to boost them up so they can fully see who they are.
But seeing that whole picture instead of just the focus on the challenges is really important. You know, we have really, really seen that so many times just recently, how understanding themselves and their learning is really important for our dyslexic students, for all of our students, really. But it's quite freeing. Because, you know, as you said, they can be so hard on themselves because they're very aware that they can't perform the way they should. And it comes out in different ways. We're working right now with two 10-year-old boys who are incredibly bright and were profoundly dyslexic when they started with us in terms of, you know, their reading and writing. And one of them, he just flat out refused to engage at first, so that he looked aggressive and non-compliant. And the other one was like a little actor, you know, he would avoid like crazy by being chatty and charming. And then when he would start reading, he'd put on this happy-go-lucky attitude like, hey, no problem, I've totally got this. And then you'd hear his voice start to get choked up when he started to read. And both of these boys are still in the process of correcting their reading challenges, but they're doing really well. Recognizing their dyslexia was an important first step for both of them to even be open to moving forward with the critical next step of addressing, you know, the underlying issues of visual disorientation and symbol confusion and auditory processing of sounds that have to be developed so the reading remediation could make sense for them.
Yes. You know, and those boys are great examples of how people compensate behaviorally, right? Yeah. So you have the, I'd rather be bad than stupid. And the other one is, I'm charismatic and I can talk my way around the situation, which a lot of CEOs, politicians, like, you know, very successful dyslexic ones do. And I mean, it's like a strength is how do I read the room? How do I work this situation to my advantage? So these are just ways that we're so focused on kids' behaviors. And this is about trying to go behind the behavior to understand what's going on so they can understand what's going on and then have different options.
Absolutely. So there are different types of dyslexic thinking styles. In your practice, what do you see in terms of dyslexic profiles?
Well, you know, we see, when we think about the umbrella of dyslexia, there can be phonological processing issues, as you mentioned, you know, matching a sound to a symbol, and that's thought to occur in the phonological part of the brain, the phonological module of the brain. Then we also see often where there is a visual component where a child has visual processing issues that impact the dyslexia. The fancy words dysphonetic dyslexia for the phonetic, and then dysidetic for the visual. And then we also see often a combination where a child can have an underlying auditory processing or phonological processing issue and a visual processing issue. When we do the testing, what we are trying to do is figure out where those problems lie, primarily because if there's a profound visual processing issue, we really want to get some help with the developmental optometrist and perhaps some vision therapy to help with that underlying visual processing system. Because even when you use a multisensory approach, as you all do so well, and what is research empirically based for helping dyslexia, if kids are not able to see a symbol accurately because of the way their eyes aren't teaming, it's going to really get in the way of the multisensory intervention. It could still work, but it might work slower. So really, we're trying to figure out where they fall on the different, you know, every dyslexic profile has similarities and everyone is different. And it's what is this child's and how much do we have to start at the heavier load of the phonemic awareness or phonological processing and how much might be a little more visual based and what is both?
Yeah. That's why I love talking to you so much. We just, you know, we speak the same language. I love it. So sometimes dyslexia gets confused, or certainly it can overlap with dysgraphia and ADHD.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. And it often can come go together. I think the other reason we really feel strongly about accurate diagnosis is sometimes we see full-blown dyslexics who are labeled as ADHD because everyone's focusing on the executive functioning, the working memory issues. And they're saying, well, the reason they're having trouble reading is because of their attention. And other times it's quite the opposite. Where people are saying, well, someone's dyslexic when they also have an attentional issue. And sometimes both are at play. So here's, and then there's dysgraphia. So dysgraphia, the fine motor challenges, motor output, which a lot of times just, to be stereotypical, people are like, oh, it's a sloppy boy syndrome, sloppy boy handwriting syndrome. And the thing is, there's usually when someone has really sloppy handwriting, it's a problem. And so much of school is about written output to gather your information and then to show what you know. So here's what we say. With dyslexia, an underlying challenge with reading and writing, phonological processing and spelling, you very often have dysgraphia. So you almost always have the fine motor issue. But you can have dysgraphia without having dyslexia. This is where it gets complicated. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when we have someone who is a poor speller, it can be related to dysgraphia, and it's also often related to dyslexia. Mm-hmm. So overlaps. Dyslexics and people with ADHD tend to have executive functioning challenges. They tend to have problems with sequencing, both in daily life and in learning. What do you do first? What do you do second? What do you do third? So that executive functioning component has an overlap. With ADHD, you also tend to have a problem with attention and distractibility and focus and task initiation and completion for activities outside of reading and writing. Because I think one of the things that we see like with kids who are in language arts and they're in reading, writing, spelling, and they're staring out the window and people are saying they can't focus. Well, some of the kids do have attentional issues, but a lot of those kids, they don't understand what's going on. So they just check out. And so again, we really want to take a look at if there's an executive functioning issue, like what profile does this child have? And if you are appropriately remediating dyslexia, and there is an undiagnosed or untreated also primary attentional issue, that is going to get in the way even of the intervention. And I'm wondering, Joe, what you guys see at your center, how often that happens where attention is actually getting in the way of the work that you're doing.
You know, we do see that. We see it more often that attention is a symptom of the challenges that the student is having. Mm-hmm. And so as those challenges, you know, begin to lessen and they get stronger with their underlying skills, a lot of times the attention issues just kind of fall away as well. But, you know, sometimes attention is a huge piece of the puzzle and we have to deal with that as its own piece. And especially with that visual disorientation on the page, it's really hard to pay attention to the page when it's making you feel seasick or, you know, it's moving around. And so, you know, our dyslexic kids often are very creative thinkers. And so, man, they can just, you know, create so many amazing things in their own mind. And so, you know, I think it can be very connected. Dr. Dan, let's talk a little bit more about identity development in kids with dyslexia or other learning challenges. Mm-hmm. What are some things we need to be aware of, think about?
Well, just like all identity development, you know, our kids are developing an identity, you know, from the moment they're born, but really it starts to develop in the school years more, and then particularly in the middle school, teenage years, and then, you know, through high school and college, you know, we're figuring out who we are. And when we think about our own paths of figuring out who we are and what we wore and the things that we did and what color hair we had or anything that phases we went through, it's a process. And the same thing is with identity development about one's learning style, learning profile, and how that goes into one's overall identity. So in an ideal world, we want to be able to say, oh, well, you know what? You are really bright. You have all of these strengths and you have dyslexia, which makes this and this and this hard, which is why you go to tutoring, why you have the school plan, and why you get pulled out. And we want our kids to be like, oh, great, cool. I have dyslexia. Great. It usually doesn't work that way. It can actually. It can in remarkable ways work that way. But a lot of times it's a process of a child, particularly going through end of elementary school, middle school and beyond, where they're trying to fit in. They don't want to have a deficit. I mean, they don't even want to have a pimple, right? They don't. So we have to be aware of feeding them this information little by little, and not always expecting the response that we want to hear, but know that it's slowly going in. You know, I was sharing in our earlier conversation that of our three kids, they each had different journeys in terms of their identity development with their learning profile. Our youngest was right away, she disowned it because by then we had a dyslexic family and she was young when we identified it, and it's just the way it was. Our middle guy was so creative and in his own kind of space, it didn't really, the label didn't impact him. What impacted him was when teachers didn't understand the struggle and didn't give him the accommodations that he knew that he was supposed to get. And our oldest, who we were learning from and with, it took her the longest to step into even saying the name dyslexia, to advocating for herself. And then once it all started to come together towards high school and now in college, it's like, she owns it. She talks about it all the time, but it was a long one. And it was like, nope, not talking about this. And what we learned is to, and what I've learned through my clients is to respect their journey, but also to keep providing information to them that they can incorporate when they're ready, as they understand what they're really good at and what's hard for them, which is being human.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's great. As parents and teachers, you know, we really, of course, want to help our struggling students. And sometimes finding that balance of helping them enough, but not too much, is a real challenge. So how do we keep accommodating from becoming enabling?
Yeah, that's the magic question. And I know we are totally aligned on the idea of scaffolding, which is, you know, as what, when we scaffold for our kids, we're trying to, you know, provide that literal scaffolding so they can step up one level to be able to do whatever they need to do with our help, whether it's sitting with them at the island, whether it's reading to them, whether it's them dictating to us. And what I say is, we don't need our child to struggle and be stressed and anxious unnecessarily. So we want to support and accommodate to reduce that level of stress and anxiety so they can step into it. And we want to stretch them a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean we say at this age and at this grade, we're done. You're on your own. It means you're constantly thinking about, as a parent, how can I help my child get to this next level of independence? How do I provide some support? And how do I, over time, allow for a little struggle to give them the opportunity to see that they can do it on their own? And there isn't a magic formula, except in my experience, of thinking about it in a way where you know your child's improving in skills and you think they can handle a little more, even sometimes if it's, you're going to go through a meltdown, because that's the old dance, and you're still there in proximity, you're still there to help them, but you're saying, you know what, I need you to do this for 5 minutes on your own, I'll be right here. And then I will come in and help you, because some of our kids just get used to us being there to do it for them. And that's doing a disservice as they get older and eventually are going to have to do some things on their own as well.
That is a snippet that everybody needs to go back and listen to. It's really hard. You know, your kids get to a certain point and, you know, the message from the school, the message from the kids, you think, okay, I'm this age, I need to be independent, leave me alone, you know, or the school will think, hey, they're in seventh grade, they need to be independent. And so thinking, instead of, okay, now you need to be independent, how can I help them take the next step towards independence? I think is a great way to think about it. And also being aware, it's so easy for us to get into habits of always helping them. So I love that picture of what's the next step that we can take. Thank you for that. One of the things that is really important to me to make sure that parents understand is that the challenges associated with dyslexia can be changed. As Dr. Dan talked about earlier, there are different dyslexic profiles, and there's been a fair amount of research around dyslexia. Pat Lindemood's research showed that an inability to process the number, order, and identity of sounds in words will make it almost impossible to learn and use phonics effectively for reading and spelling. We see this challenge consistently with dyslexia, and we know that this function, phonemic awareness, can be developed through auditory training. Ron Davis, Dr. Deborah Sunbeck, and Dr. Terry Lawton have all researched and developed techniques for addressing the visual disorientation issue that we talked about earlier, that is so distressing for many dyslexic individuals. These researchers are all independent of each other, and we have been able to apply their various techniques very successfully with dyslexic students. Dr. Sally Shaywitz, in her research on the dyslexic brain, found that many dyslexic students are processing reading more on the right side of the brain than in the left language hemisphere, and using only one part of the reading pathway that good readers use. Because we know what those pathways are, and because of brain plasticity, then we also know that more effective neural pathways can be developed. Your dyslexic learner has a unique and remarkable thinking style. He or she will probably always think differently, which is great. But what we want to do is remove the disability part of it. This process certainly takes time. So all of the supports and things that Dr. Dan talked about are critical along the way. Well, Dr. Dan, you have a wonderful parenting podcast called Parent Footprint. So I know we're really running over time, but what would you like parents to take away today about parenting dyslexic learners?
The journey. I think parenting dyslexic learners it's an adventure. And know that you are raising a really incredible human being. It comes with challenges of them having to go through the system, and the traditional education system is not made for a dyslexic learner. Dyslexic learners are outside the box thinkers and problem solvers and intuitive, and are always thinking ahead and thinking differently. And just to know that it's your guide, it's your mission to guide them into really understanding and fully actualizing who they are, despite the system in which we all live. And what we say about most dyslexics at the end, the ones that really get the encouragement and support, is they say they are who they are because of their dyslexia, not in spite of their dyslexia.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Dan. We love having you on the show, and always appreciate your compassion and your energy and your insights.
Thanks, Jill. Really enjoyed it.
Be sure to check out his new book, Bright Complex Kids, Supporting Their Social Emotional Development, and his parenting podcast, Parent Footprint. You can find it wherever you listen to podcasts. This is LD Expert Live, your place for answers and solutions for learning disabilities, dyslexia, and auditory and attention challenges. Stoll Learning Centers are open for both on-site and remote sessions and evaluations. We work with children and adults doing targeted brain training to permanently eliminate struggles associated with dyslexia, auditory processing, and other learning differences so that students can become independent learners and thrive in school. If you would like a free consultation for yourself or your child, give us a call or visit our website at stowellcenter.com. Thank you again, Dr. Dan. Thank you all of you who have been sharing, subscribing, asking questions, and joining us each week. We'll see you next Tuesday.